Our next case this morning is case number 092697, Pirius versus Abbott Laboratories. Ms. Potter.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, Judge Bauer, Judge Sykes, Judge Hamilton, and we meet again here. And on behalf of Mr. Pirius, I'm Robin Potter, my esteemed co-counsel, John DeRose, opposing counsel. Good morning. In our appendix, starting at page 190 and 191, we set forth COSA's admissions in its SEC report that in February 2005, COSA or Abbott, we will refer to them as Abbott, which is now the current employer, learned that the Office of Inspector General of the United States Department of Health and Human Services, OIG, in conjunction with the Department of Justice, was conducting an investigation of COSA's marketing and sales activities. The company believes the federal investigation was initiated by a whistleblower, that it's a QI-TAM, and that these are sealed and the company has not been able to review it. Appendix page 191. In March of 2005, the Office of Inspector General served investigatory subpoenas on COSA. The Wisconsin subpoena requested documents. COSA has produced and continues to provide the government with additional documents. Another subpoena was issued. In October of 2006, now we are over a year after the issuance of the initial subpoena, COSA had a preliminary meeting with the Fraud Section of the Department of Justice Criminal Division regarding coordination of the criminal investigation by the government. An adverse outcome in any of these matters could result in substantial civil and criminal fines. In March 2005, Mr. Pirius, who is not an officer of the company. He is the highest ranking employee of this company, of Abbott, to receive a subpoena from the Department of Justice. He's a regional director. People work under him. He doesn't know what a subpoena is. He is Willie Loman. He's a salesman. He does what he's told until he knows something is not right, and then he questions it and stops, as we will see. He brings it to the employer. They say, Greg, we are your friend. You do not need a lawyer. You will communicate with the Department of Justice through us. And Judge Kaur correctly finds that Abbott becomes his conduit. Through whom? Through John Hogan, a former U.S. attorney. And these are important in establishing our elements of the cause of action and why Judge Kaur and Abbott are both erroneous on whether or not this case should proceed to trial. Greg cooperates with Abbott and their lawyers and with the Department of Justice from the day he receives that subpoena in March 2005 till the day he's fired on November 16, 2006. He believes he is cooperating every day that he breathes and goes to work. He turns over his hard drive. He saves everything. And later we learn in this case that the flimsy, flim-flam reason given for his termination, some alleged discussion he had with an employee, which we never get to due to the Fifth Amendment, is concerning some PowerPoint presentation that he allegedly discussed with this other employee, was actually turned over by Greg to the Department of Justice in March 2005, remained on his computer throughout the course of his employment, never deleted, and was sent by him everywhere. That goes more to causation and pretext.
Right. And Judge Kaur didn't really decide this case on that aspect of it. He decided this case based on our case law that seems to impose a subjective belief requirement on this retaliation cause of action in order for the statutory language of protected activity in furtherance of an action under the FCA to have been satisfied. And so our threshold question is whether that's an appropriate interpretation of the statute. I don't see a whole lot of factual disputes about the chronology here. There's a factual dispute about the reason for his firing, but Judge Core didn't even get to that.
We agree. Causation was not before His Honor, Judge Core. He didn't rule on it. We're prepared to discuss it only because the defendant raised it. We dealt with it in our reply brief. But we concur, Your Honor, Judge Sykes, that the question here is statutory interpretation and what has been mangled below and cries out for correction by this court. 3730H, any employee who is discharged, demoted, suspended, threatened, harassed, or in any other manner discriminated against in the terms and conditions of employment by his or her employer because of lawful acts done by the employee on behalf of the employee or others in furtherance of an action under this section, including investigation for, initiation of, testimony for, or assistance in an action to be filed or filed, is entitled to relief to be made whole. This case is different than any other case that has been in this circuit, including the case, Your Honor, Judge Hamilton presided over in Abner. In this case, Abner versus Jewish Hospital Health Services, which was also a retaliation case, which you, Your Honor, correctly ruled should proceed to trial. This case is different than any case before this court. We are very proud that the first False Claims Act case ever in the history of this country under Section 3730H was tried in our circuit before His Honor Judge Plunkett and affirmed by Justice Estabrook in Neal versus Honeywell. That set the tone. This is a broad statute to protect whistleblowers because fraud is rampant in this country. And in order to eradicate it, the 1986 amendments to the False Claims Act issued Section H.
And Ms. Potter, let me ask you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Obviously, we have some cases that talk about this requirement of a reasonable subjective belief test. What do you see as the purpose of that test, and how do you think those purposes are or are not implicated in a case like this where the issue concerns compliance with a subpoena?
Good question, and we deal with it very strongly in our briefs and in the amicus. Because this is a monumental question facing the courts in this country and this court taking the lead here. When you have a subpoena, the first element of what we need to prove in this circuit that whether the relator engaged in protected activity has been met. There is no other case like this in this circuit. He gets a subpoena. He cooperates with the subpoena. That is assistance. That is testimony for. It's a prima facie case, and what we say in the reply, and maybe too strongly, the lawful acts of production of documents are in furtherance of a QTAM investigation, period. Reply at 5. To do more would mangle this statute and undo the hard work that the Congress has done since 1986 in amending the retaliation provisions to provide incentives for whistleblowers to come forward. And because there's a subpoena, there's no requirement of a subjective intent. It's not in this statute. We understand it's been engrafted by some of the circuits, but it is contrary to the statute, and we need not get there in the subpoena context. The reason, Your Honor, Judge Hamilton, for the requirement of a subjective intent really falls under Leg 2 and Leg 1 both, and are these Chicken Little suits? Are these frivolous suits? You don't get there when the employee is cooperating in a government investigation because the wolf is at the door and it was at Abbott's door and they knew it. As Judge Sykes said, there is no factual issue. There is no reason to engraft a subjective intent requirement on an innocent whistleblower like Greg Perius. He is doing what Senator Grassley in the Congress intended. He is giving the government information to prosecute fraudsters like Abbott. That's what it was meant to do. And if you permit what Abbott suggests, that there's no protection to a whistleblower who is involuntarily complying with a subpoena, we will turn the False Claims Act on its head. There are over 80,000 employees at Abbott. If the message is you don't have to comply with a subpoena because the Seventh Circuit won't protect you, we talk about that in the amicus, how dangerous it is to the whistleblowers of this country to not have that protection. The 11th Circuit got it right in Childry. That's the closest analogous case. We cite it often. In that case, DOJ did a friend of the court brief, which obviously is available to all of us, and said there is no subjective intent requirement when someone is responding to a subpoena. I do apologize. We just did submit today to the clerk the Gobble decision, which came down from the First Circuit, which said the same thing. That was in Gobble. The guy complains over and over again about fraud, and it was brought to my attention recently when it just settled for $313 million. I feel compelled to share with the court the dimension of the problem of what's going on in this country and why whistleblowers like Greg Perius, who don't put it all together, should be protected, just like this court said in Fansel. He is not a lawyer, as the D.C. Circuit said in Yasumi.
Get closer to the microphone.
Thank you, Judge. I'm sorry. He's not a lawyer.
Well, he's also not a whistleblower in the classic sense of the word. That's not to say he's not covered by the statute and doesn't have a claim, but he was involuntarily responding to a subpoena issued by the federal government in connection with an FCA complaint that was filed by another whistleblower.
I don't think the real
focused question here is whether that act qualifies as protected activity under the statute so that any retaliation against him on that basis is illegal, and that requires a construction of this in furtherance of language in connection or together with the language in the statute that refers to assistance in an action filed or to be filed. And it seems to me that the context of the cases in which the subjective reasonable belief of the plaintiff was important as a limiting principle on the statute was an individual investigation initiated by the plaintiff,
correct,
himself or herself in an action yet to be filed.
Correct.
And that sort of a limiting principle is simply not applicable in the context of this case. And so I appreciate all your arguments about the stakes and the consequences and the massive problem of fraud, et cetera, but what we really have is a very focused question of statutory interpretation, so perhaps you could address yourself to that.
If I may, I think it's twofold. He meets the definition of the statute. There is already a filed KETAM. You don't have to go there to say whether or not, as in Neil, there's a distinct possibility. The wolf's at the door. You can't close the door. It's there. Abbott is dealing with a civil and criminal investigation, and they say that they can face a criminal indictment due to Greg's documents. I do take issue, Your Honor, with the construct that he is not also a whistleblower. We have established in Fanslow and Neil that part of the internal investigation, he is blowing the whistle. He is saying, this company is guilty of illegal activities. I am concerned. You gave a seminar that we could go to jail, and you are telling us to continue paying doctors, taking them on golf outings. The son of the CEO has given me Bulls tickets to give to the doctors. I will not do it. That is taking action in furtherance of a KETAM, and it's also assisting the government action by saying, I will not do what the subpoena has asked to produce documents on that are problematic that you have told us we will go to jail. That is an action in furtherance of a KETAM. But the main action he takes is in compliance with the subpoena and then his internal whistleblowing. It melds, Your Honor, Judge Sykes, because the same time he's talking to Hogan, the former U.S. attorney, who says, Greg, this is limited to the Wisconsin region. We don't want to hear anymore. And he is saying, Greg is a thorn in their side till the day he is fired. And he says, I want to tell you, this is about nationwide illegal practices. We are still paying doctors. We are still taking them out to golf. This has been illegal since 2003. You told us we could go to jail, and nobody is stopping it. They're doing it in New York. And what do they tell him, Judge Sykes? They tell him to be quiet. We heard enough, Greg. This is just like Yasudian and Fansel. Be quiet. Go away. That goes to the causation. But it does answer your question on the whistleblowing.
Ms. Potter, let me get to the – if we reach the causation issue, you were referring to some roadblocks you reached in discovery with the Fifth Amendment. Can you direct me to what evidence we've got in this record about what management was told, what the decision makers were told about this conversation that your client had in the bathroom about the document retention policy?
We don't know because Mr. Hogan and
can you get closer to the microphone? Can you get closer to the microphone?
They claim privilege and Fifth Amendment privilege. So after successive motions to compel, we finally got the reasons for the termination, which are very fluid. Sometimes it's obstruction of justice. Sometimes it was violation of the document retention policy. But still, we didn't know what the decision makers relied on because Abbott claimed privilege under the Fifth Amendment and other privileges. So we never got there. We move for summary judgment on this record. We believe it's enough that we have established causation and retaliatory animus, that one of two things happened. We can win through this court, or you can just say the district court never dealt with it, remand for trial, as Your Honor did in your case when you were on the trial court. I'd like to reserve my time, if I may. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hurst.
May it please the court. Jim Hurst on behalf of Abbott Laboratories. The district court should be affirmed on either of two independent grounds, this protected activity element or the but-for cause element. On the protected activity element, below, Mr. Pirius argued that he engaged in three different forms of protected activity, but he only appeals two of those three forms of protected activity, specifically complying with the government document subpoena, and secondly, participating in these confidential in-house interviews. I want to start with the interviews before I get to the subpoena very briefly. These interviews are hardly what anybody would consider whistleblowing activity under any stretch of this statute. These were company-initiated interviews handled by lawyers hired by COAST to defend the company against the government charges. And in these interviews, which was part of a large investigation involving many, many employee interviews, it is undisputed that they were confidential and privileged interviews. It's undisputed that Mr. Pirius knew that they were confidential and privileged interviews. It's undisputed that during these interviews, Mr. Pirius did not make any effort to report or expose fraud because he admitted that at the time he did not believe COAST did anything wrong.
It's pretty clear that the subpoena compliance is activity protected by the statute, isn't it?
And Your Honor, let me address that. But if this court were to conclude that the interview activity was not protected activity, we still win for a different reason, which is the causation issue. But let me address the subpoena issue. Look, as we read this statute, it does not say that anything that theoretically furthers a QTAM action is protected activity. It uses different language, and that language is focused on action in furtherance of. And to us, that suggests a purpose or intent. Look, there's going to be line drawing under this statute.
Under your theory, then, the company could fire somebody for complying with the subpoena?
Is that
what you're telling us?
The answer is it would not be. Yeah, the answer is yes, it would, if it's not protected activity under the circumstances of the case. What we're suggesting is that you need to look at the nature and purpose of the activity and all the circumstances to determine whether it is, in fact, protected activity.
Whether complying with a subpoena is protected activity?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In this particular case, Your Honor, when Mr. Pirius produced documents, these are the circumstances. When he produced documents, number one, he did not believe COAST had done anything wrong. So he didn't think he was doing anything to further or assist a QTAM action. Number two, the company affirmatively helped him produce the documents. Number three, the company itself produced documents, and there's no evidence in the record that he produced even one document beyond what the company itself produced.
What difference does that make?
Because in this particular instance, when you look at overall the nature and purpose of the activity, he didn't do anything beyond what the law required.
Right. But you're telling us that the company would not violate the False Claims Act if it chose to fire somebody for complying with a government subpoena.
If the compliance with the subpoena under the particular circumstances of the case was not protected activity, of course.
Why wouldn't it be protected?
Because this court's precedents talk about looking at the nature and purpose of the activity. Let me give you one.
Have any of those dealt with anything as straightforward as complying with a subpoena?
The answer is no, Your Honor.
Okay. Why don't you move on to a different subject?
Okay. Let me give one quick hypothetical on this issue. If you were to read the statute in an overly literal technical way, then the person who put the label on the box of documents that went to the subpoena, say that's all they did. I mean, one could argue that that is in furtherance of a QI-TAM action.
Do you think that's a helpful hypothetical for your position?
Well, in some ways, I'd say the answer is yes, because common sense tells you that's not the kind of person the statute was designed to protect. And Mr. Perius, in responding to a subpoena, is not the kind of person the statute was designed to protect, because the purpose of the statute is to encourage and protect those who are rooting out and exposing fraud.
How about
he was not that
testimony
person.
Testimony before a grand jury.
I'm sorry?
How about giving testimony before a grand jury?
He did not do that.
Let's talk about hypotheticals.
Yeah.
Would we have to look at the nature and circumstances of that activity in order to decide whether it was protected?
I think the answer is yes. If the person went into the grand jury and all they did was say the government, employee did nothing wrong, I don't believe they did anything wrong, and all they did was defend the company, that would not, to me, be a whistleblower under the purpose of the statute. I will take your earlier invitation to move to a different topic, Your Honor, which I probably should have taken when you made it. The causation issue. On the causation issue, it's really a two-step process, right? The first step is to identify the specific activity that qualifies as protected activity. The second step is to ask whether that particular protected activity was the but-for cause of the termination. And here, Mr. Perius does not even attempt to meet that standard, because he muddles together three different forms of activity, including the internal compliance discussions that Judge Kaur held were not protected activity, and that Mr. Perius did not appeal to this court. So just to make it very concrete, if this court were to find that responding to the subpoena was protected activity, but that participating in the confidential internal interviews was not protected activity, and those are the only two activities on appeal, then Mr. Perius's burden is to show that there's a genuine issue of fact on whether or not the subpoena response was the but-for cause of his termination. And there is no evidence in that. First of all, he doesn't argue it.
Can we go back, I'm sorry, for a second, though, to your, not the subpoena compliance, but this participating in the internal interviews.
Sure.
And there I have a little more trouble disregarding nature and circumstances of the events. I understand your argument to be, well, the government is the adversary. Anything we do to help the company respond cannot be in furtherance. But I can surely imagine a lot of situations in which senior management, let's say, thinks, well, yeah, maybe there is a bad apple here. Maybe we've got a rogue division. And it's going to help us, help the government, and set up some fire breaks to protect the company itself if we do a thorough internal investigation, put it out on a silver platter for the government, and convince them that we ought to sacrifice this handful of people, this division, and so on. And so I can easily see how an internal investigation might well be in furtherance of a QI-TAM action.
Under different circumstances, it may be possible, Your Honor, but that is not this case. Because in this particular case, what was being investigated, according to Mr. Perius himself, was company-wide practices. The individual interviews, and there were many, many, I think the number was 70 or so, Mr. Perius has not suggested that he implied, attempted to imply, or reported fraud in any of these investigations, number one. Number two, he hasn't suggested that he provided any unique information in these interviews that somehow singled him out for whistleblower protection when the other 69 or so people who were interviewed would not qualify for whistleblower protection. But these interviews were absolutely handled with the purpose of developing a defense for Coase. They were confidential. They were privileged. Nobody could believe that that was whistleblower activity, particularly where Mr. Pirius is saying that he himself did not believe at the time the company had done anything wrong. And that brings us to his causation problem, which is this. With his causation problem, if this court were to say subpoena activity is protected, but the confidential interviews were not, then the burden for Mr. Pirius is to argue, me complying with that subpoena was the but-for cause of my termination. He never makes that argument. He doesn't. And there's no evidence in the record to support it. And it's not just the 18-month interval between him complying with the subpoena and his termination, but it's also the fact that the company itself complied with the document subpoena. Two other employees complied with the document supporter a subpoena, neither of whom were fired, and we affirmatively assisted Mr. Pirius in complying with that subpoena. There is no evidence, for instance, that we discouraged him in any way, shape, or form with fully complying with the government subpoena. There is no evidence in the record that we were all upset with how Mr. Pirius handled the subpoena response. There's no evidence in the record that we discouraged him from producing any particular document, or we had a debate about whether something should be produced. There's no evidence in the record that he produced even a single document that the company itself did not produce. So where does that leave us? Why would Coase retaliate against Mr. Pirius for doing something that the company itself did and for doing something that we actively encouraged him to do and assisted him in doing? There's nothing in the record showing any causal connection, zero, any causal connection between the subpoena response and his termination. Nor is there...
What are we to make of the fact that the company's stated reason concerning this document was one concerned a document that both he and the company had already produced?
Well, two things. The first is this. You don't get to, legally, the way it works is you don't get to our proffered reason for his termination unless he establishes
it. I'm there. Just go ahead and answer the question.
Okay, until you get the genuine dispute. Okay. The answer is this, Your Honor. He wasn't terminated for actually destroying the document. What he was terminated for is following a subordinate into a bathroom, having a conversation that he admits occurred where he said, I'm concerned about how the government would view this particular PowerPoint. And he admits that he and the employee, that he raised concerns about how whether that document was still on people's computers. And he also admits that there was a discussion about going out after this bathroom conversation and talking to others about whether or not that document was on their computers.
But complying with the document retention policy, which sometimes that's a euphemism for a document destruction policy. I'm aware of that. But what about the problem that your opposing counsel raised concerning discovery about this decision process, privileges being claimed, so that if we get to the subjective inquiry, it was blocked?
The Fifth Amendment privileges were properly invoked. The attorney-client privileges were properly invoked. And that does not in any way, shape, or form eliminate the plaintiff's burden with respect to this but-for cause
what
issue.
It means is that there's a lot that's in dispute about the reasons for his termination.
I would grant you that Judge Kaur held that there were disputed issues about whether Abbott's proffered reason for the termination were or were not true. But that doesn't change the core fact that it is Mr. Pirius's burden to show that there was a but-for causal connection between his subpoena response and his termination. He has that burden to show.
And a pretext is not doesn't take you a long way down that road?
Well, I think the answer to that is no, because the first thing you ask yourself is, has the plaintiff showed a genuine issue of fact about what he says was the reason for his termination?
Well, let's suppose what we've got is somebody who's engaged in protected activity and who's fired for a reason that could be treated as pretextual.
Right.
Isn't that good enough?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, for instance, to take your hypothetical a little bit farther, what if the protected activity occurred 10 years before the termination And the protected activity was the same kind of conduct of the company itself engaged in and many others engaged in.
Okay. We don't have 10 years here. We have the beginning and later stages of the same investigation.
But my point, logical point is this, Your Honor. Even if you find that the proffered reason was pretext, that doesn't change the fact that this court has to focus on whether or not there was a genuine issue of fact about but-for causation. And here, it's hard for me to – the allegation makes no logical sense. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that we had any ill feelings towards Mr. Perius for doing what we ourselves did and that we helped him do.
Usually in civil litigation, when people take the Fifth, the opposing party is entitled to an adverse inference.
But in this case, the Fifth was not taken for anything having to do with Mr. Perius. The Fifth was taken by the employees in connection with the government investigation relating to their marketing practices.
I thought it had to do with the discussions about the reasons for firing him and the discussion in the bathroom about the PowerPoint presentation.
That's not correct. It was a broad assertion over the details of the investigation in connection with the marketing practices. And the Fifth Amendment assertions were by employees who didn't want to talk about anything they did at the company in connection with the marketing practices because that was the subject of a government investigation.
Well, did the decision makers, the folks who decided to fire Mr. Perius, invoke the Fifth?
Not in connection with why they terminated Mr. Perius. All they did was invoke the attorney-client privilege. In connection with the underlying investigation, but they did testify quite specifically about why they terminated him. They said they terminated him because it came to their attention that he was encouraging others to go out.
Well, wasn't that breaching the privilege? I mean, didn't that information come from the lawyers?
Well, that was a line that was drawn by the court itself. When there was a privilege discussion down below, the court said they have testified why they did. But the underlying investigation itself, you can maintain the privilege over, and that's how it was shaken out.
What about the other party to this bathroom conversation, Mr. Niedbalski? He took the Fifth and refused to testify about the contents of that conversation?
He did, in fact, take the Fifth and refused to testify about not only that conversation, but pretty much any activities that he engaged in while at the company, as did many other employees because of the ongoing government investigation about marketing practices. I see my red light is up, but the core issue I would ask this court to focus on is whether there's a genuine issue of fact about the subpoena response itself and whether it has any causal connection to the termination, and we submit that it does not, and there's no such evidence to support it. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you. Ms. Potter, I think your time had expired. I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal. We asked a lot of questions at the end of your argument.
Thank you so much, Your Honors, for the 1 minute of rebuttal, and we do rebut most seriously. We took over 25 depositions in this case and were blocked over and over and over again by Fifth Amendment, from Niedbalski on the bathroom to Hogan. Who did you investigate? What did they say? Isn't it true that Greg Perius is the only man who blew the whistle internally and told you you had nationwide fraud? Greg Perius gave them information, which Hogan admitted in his deposition that we attached to the appendix, that could put them in jail. No one else did it. The comparatives are profound. Glickman threw his computer in the river, was never prosecuted. Their head of compliance destroyed index cards under their document retention policy, were never prosecuted. We ask you to look at our summary judgment. We were ready for trial and went in on our pretrial conference date, only to have Judge Kaur, His Honor, give us the memorandum opinion. This is an outrageous case where one man is scapegoated and prosecuted over and over again. Everyone in his region is saying, what is going on here? They're trying to blame us. And what happened to the architects of this fraud? The owner of the company walked with $1.2 billion from Abbott. Greg Perius walked with nothing but a mound of depression and debt, and they stole his $5 million options because they claimed he engaged in a violation of some abstract company policy. The men who were the architects who investigated Greg Perius, they admit. We ask you to look at the facts. Thank you, judges.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under